morning and welcome to episode 83 of the Dexies podcast, brought to you by GatheringMagic.com. My name is Erin Campbell. My guest tonight has written for just about every major magic site you can think of, but you probably know him based on his recent appearance at GP Cincinnati, where he won the whole damn thing. Here with me to talk about it is Kyle Bogomes. Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi, how are you doing, Kyle?
Doing great. Excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you here. I'm a big fan of yours.
Oh, thanks.
I was at home rooting for you when you were in Cincinnati, and when you won, I was like, I'm on the same website as he is, and I was very proud. So you were doing GM proud over there.
What's that?
I said you were doing GM proud over there.
Doing GM, yeah, that's true.
Now, you said something very interesting when we were exchanging emails to get together, Kyle. You said that you did not have Skype, and you also did not have a microphone. Is that true?
Yep, this is the first time I've ever Skyped, and I just had to do a mic check just to see if it actually worked.
Wow, that's so crazy. That's actually been coming up a lot lately with potential guests. Adrian Sullivan is somebody who I like to say turned me down to be on the show. I like to say that he's the one that got away. And I ran into him at SCG Milwaukee this weekend, and I reminded him of that. And I was like, so, Adrian, still too good to come on my show? And he was like, I never said that. He's like, I just don't like Skype. And I was like, really? And Adrian was like, if we could just do it live or if we could do something, I just don't want to download it, and I really hate Skype. So you're actually not the first person to say that, surprisingly, which I just assumed everybody had Skype, but I guess that's not the case.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of break out of my comfort zone, give it a shot. Some of the classes, you know, you have to do, like, PowerPoints with voiceover, so figured I need to get it anyway.
So you're going to thank me one day. You're going to be like, oh, thank God she made me get Skype.
Yeah, you know, I kind of had to learn it immediately, so yeah, it's cool.
Fantastic, fantastic. I know another program my World of Warcraft friends like to use is something called Mumble, but that's something where unless you play an MMO or you have some other reason to download it, you have no need for it. So I've thought about using other programs, but I try to, you know, inconvenience my guests as little as possible. I feel bad enough when I have to download Skype, much less, hey, download this other program you're never going to use again just to be on my show. I feel like a little bit of a jerk.
I've never heard of it.
Yeah, you're really not missing much. Like I said, unless you play WoW or, I mean, maybe if you played other games, but that's really the only thing it's good for. So let's go ahead and talk about you, because you've had quite a life. I admit when I first started researching you, I didn't think I was going to find very much, and I found a lot. So let's go ahead and talk about you here. So one of the first things I found out about you, Kyle, is the Oakland Press News actually wrote an article about you in 2010, and it said that you started playing Magic at 5 years old.
Oh, yeah.
Five. Tell me about that.
Man, I've been playing for almost 20 years on and off, looking at the date now.
So what was it like at 5 years old? Like, how did that get started?
So my cousins, Adam and Steven, they were, you know, they started playing Magic, like, I think around Revised. And, you know, I was maybe like four at that time. So I would always just pretty much emulate what they did. And they always had their friends over, they were playing cards. So I wanted to know what it is that they did. And I wanted to do everything they did. So I got into Magic. But I didn't really know how to read at the time. So it was interesting. I would call them pretty much every day, like whenever I'd buy a pack of cards, and I would just name off all the letters. It's like, what is this card? I'd spell it out for them. One time I called at like 8 o'clock in the morning, and it's like, are you guys busy? I got some cards. What are they?
Did you ever read the – because I remember what the starter decks were like back then, and they had that really fat rule book that you could fold 20 times over that had all of the text and the example hands. Did you eventually learn how to read that too?
No, I never actually saw anything like that.
Really?
I was pretty bad – when I started playing, of course, and I didn't really get the hang of it for a while. So they just kind of taught me what they knew at the time, which, you know, they might not have even known all the rules at that point, too, because they're, you know, they just pretty much played at the kitchen table at that time.
So how did you play without being able to read the cards? Or did you just sort of judge that the pictures look cool, or did you see the big numbers on the right-hand side?
Oh, God. Yeah, it was... Mostly pictures, of course. I always assumed that the cards with cool pictures would have been worse. So I, you know, the cards that were, you know, like the dual lands and stuff, like I always saw them playing that and Birds of Paradise. They looked kind of lame, so I just kind of assumed that the lamer the picture was, the better the card was.
See, I would have been the opposite. I think I would have gone with the prettier picture. Like, I'd have been like, oh, this card is beautiful. It must do lots. And then, you know, it's like a pyroblast or something silly.
Yeah, I knew, and I learned the hard way. So it's like, okay, I'm just going to resist the urge. I'm just going to go with these pictures. I don't really know what they say or why they're good or bad, but, you know, they play them, so I'm going to do that.
So would you say that Magic also helped you learn how to read?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Wow.
Read,
math,
You're
actually not the first person to say that. I had a guest on my show once, Scotty Mack from the A-Team, mm-hmm. and he has a small child, he had a boy, and he said at the time, you know, he had a son that just wasn't applying himself, and he, you know, was playing Yu-Gi-Oh, and he was learning Yu-Gi-Oh, and then, you know, he saw Scott play Magic, and he wanted to get into it, and Scott was like, you know, we've already tried everything, you're not willing to learn how to read, like, we're doing it for you, unless you can learn how to do it, you can't play Magic, and the kid just pulled it together and started learning how to read, and he credited Magic for him, too, so that's great to hear.
Yeah, especially, like, you know, you have a lot of people who started playing at the beginning who are now old enough to have kids, and they're, you know, they're all teaching their kids how to play, so I see it on Facebook every once in a while. You know, it's like, oh, I'm so proud, you know, my kid's learning how to play, and, you know, they're really young. So, I think that's going to be a pretty big trend. I think it was kind of rare back, you know, back in, like, 95, just because the game was so new.
Mm-hmm. It's crazy to think about it, that we're at the age where we can teach our kids.
Yeah, don't remind me of...
So as you got older, you started going to F&M, mm-hmm. and you started getting better at the game. What made you decide that you wanted to take the next step and become competitive?
Well, when I was in elementary school, I played basketball, and that was kind of my competitive outlet. And then I was... you know, I don't know if you've ever seen me at a tournament or anything, but I'm not very tall. And when I was in elementary school, I was even shorter. I was, you know, definitely like the shortest kid in my class. So I kind of, you know, moved away from basketball after, like, you know, third or fourth grade, just because, you know, I'd go to practice, but, you know, I just wasn't very good. So after a while, I kind of moved away from that. And then I actually took a short break from Magic. You know, I kind of learned how to read from it, and I would play with my cousins. But I never really played at school. So around fourth grade, I kind of got back into it after I moved away from basketball and, you know, pretty much the athletic stuff. So I kind of went into nerd mode at the end of elementary school. Mm-hmm. And then I think my first F&M was in seventh grade. I don't even think I knew anyone at that time that I went with. I just kind of, I saw it at the mall, you know, they'd have like the Wizards of the Coast shops in the mall. They don't have them anymore, but this is in like 2001. So they would, you know, I saw some people playing, and it's like, shit, they still have, you know, people actually play this game still. I didn't even know, I hadn't seen the cards in a while. So I, this is in like, I think Invasion was the new set at this time.
I remember that.
So I went, you know, I learned, like, what the difference between Type 1 and Type 2 was, and I, you know, asked a bunch of people some questions, and then eventually built a deck, and it was like, you know, a traditional little kid green-white deck, because I think I was probably 11 at that time. So, you know, I went 2-2, got smashed, but came back for more and kept going 2-2, and eventually, like, kind of worked my way up and got all the cards.
Mm-hmm. So what was your first serious event after F&M?
I think it was, I moved, I started with F&M for a couple of years, and then I went to, I think it was the Onslaught pre-release. It was in 2003 at Pandemonium. That was like where they, you know, they had all the big pre-releases back then. Mm-hmm. I went and gave Limited a shot. I didn't draft or play sealed very often. So that was kind of a weird experience because their pre-releases back in the day, they used to have like 300 people. So it was a far cry from the 30-person F&M that I was used to. but it was like, you know, I'd go there and there'd be this large collection of people there that are all playing, and then they had, you know, the store attached to it too, so I spent way too much money on cards that day, I remember. Like, wow, they have, like, you know, because they never sold singles at the Wizards of the Coast stores, so that was, like, one of the first places I went to where they would sell cards individually, so I thought that was really cool. And I was only 14 at the time, so I was, you know, very, very enamored with what was going on there.
Would you say that you got bit by the bug there?
Yeah, as after that pre-release, I went to, I pretty much went to all the pre-releases for the next maybe 10 years. I don't even think I missed one, you know.
Oh.
And I'm from Michigan, so the weather's pretty horrendous, and I would have to drive like an hour to, you know, just to play in pretty much any event, because all the PTQs and stuff, it was all in, you know, pretty close to the Detroit area. And I lived about an hour away from Detroit. So it was kind of a far drive, but, you know, I made the trek for all that stuff. See, I went to, like, regionals after that pre-release. And then I, you know, I pretty much just went to everything after that.
Mm-hmm. And then you went to your first pro tour.
So my first pro tour was actually really bizarre because it was in Charleston in, I think it was 2006, and it was a team pro tour.
Ooh.
And my, you know, so I, at this point, I knew some people. I was like, I was getting okay compared to the average F&M grinder. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think I had maybe like a PTQ top 8 or something like that at that time. Mm-hmm. And it was actually a family vacation because my aunt lives in South Carolina. So I thought, you know, hey, this is cool. This, you know, the pro tour is only a couple hours from my aunt's house. So we went there, and I wasn't qualified or anything. And my brother was with me. And I had a bunch of standard decks because, you know, at this point, I pretty much, I would follow, you know, all the tournament coverage, and I knew what all the good decks were. And so I gave my brother one of the format was Team Unified Constructed.
Wow.
So you had to, so on top of not knowing anyone, I had to build three standard decks. That, what Unified Constructed was that you had to stack all three decks on top of each other. And
what?
So like not actually, but basically if you stack all three decks, they have to be legal for tournament play. So you can't play more than four of any card.
Okay.
So it required a lot of collaboration in order, you know, you can't just take three random people because you might show up and, you know, one of your cards overlaps. You had to build three unique decks. And so I had all the cards to build them. So I gave my brother a deck. I had a deck. I was 15 at the time. My brother was 12 or 11, maybe. And I found one of my friends from the original F&M that I played at that, you know, he just went down to Charleston as well just to hang out. He didn't have a team or anything, so I was like...
How old was he?
He was... I'd say he was, like, probably 20 at the time.
Okay.
And he had tattoos and all this stuff. And my mom, you know, my mom went with me, obviously, because I was so young at the time. So, and he just, like, he came down on a bus. But he was a friend of mine. My mom was very skeptical. It's like, Mom, I know he came down here to hang out with my aunt and all that. But I'm going to play a tournament, and, like, I have to, like, I have to stay the night at my friend's hotel. And he came down on a bus.
That's not shady at all.
I know. It looked so bad on paper. It was hilarious.
I'm just imagining what it must look like to be sitting across from you, where it's like, you know, so I have me and my two partners, and I look across, and there's a tattooed man, two small children, and I'm just like, did this man take you? Like, what's, you can go away from him. We'll protect you. Like,
oh, yeah. It's... It got pretty absurd because we had, you know, we had to build all these decks and we weren't qualified, so we were like super ragtag, like two little kids and the guy with all the tattoos. He's an awesome guy, but like, you know, when you look on the surface, you know,
yeah,
we were like the most odd trio in the room for sure.
Right.
And we had to play the last chance qualifier and. There was 25 teams, and the top four teams qualified. And we ended up top fouring. So that was all we had to do. We only won, like, I think it was, like, we had to go, like, 4-1-1, and then we top foured. So we didn't actually have to do that much to qualify. And then the next day, we just, you know, it was like 2 in the morning at this time. We just qualified for our first pro tour. We were all super psyched about it. My brother doesn't actually play that much, so we gave him a red deck. And we're like, we actually put him in the middle. So when we would win or lose, we could help him because you were allowed to talk to your teammates. Mm-hmm. As long as you didn't get up from your seat so you couldn't see your opponent's hand or anything. So we would, you know, my brother would make, like, you know, these horrible plays, but we'd be like, no, 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 don't do that, don't do that. So it was a pretty wild ride because we, you know, we played against some people who, you know, they came to South Carolina specifically to try to qualify for the Pro Tour, and, you know, they're playing against these small children.
And the tattooed man.
And the tattooed man. And it was, yeah, so we qualified for that. But the next day, the Pro Tour was, it was Team Unified Ravnica Block Constructed. Mm. And we did not, you know, obviously we didn't test for this format. It didn't exist before or after the Pro Tour. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's the most obscure format you can imagine, right?
Yeah.
And we didn't have any of the cards for it. We only had, like, pretty much the decks that I brought. So we stayed at my friend's apartment or his hotel room, and we built a bunch of decks at the last second. Mm-hmm. And we just threw everything together, and we ended up making day two with all these decks. And once again, we gave my brother the red deck just because it's like, here, like, you're going to play against some pretty good people tomorrow. Here's, you know, here's Gruul Aggro. Like, we'll try to help you.
Now, was this like the team seal that I'm used to where you only have to get 2 wins and you're done?
Yeah, one of your team members was allowed to lose their match, and it was the best. Yeah, it was a best 2 out of 3 of best 2 out of 3s.
Okay. So then your brother, you know, could have been a little bit carried. You know, you got one, Tattoo has one, and you're like, okay, you're done, and
then we won the match.
Okay.
but some, like, the first time... the first round we played, first round of the Pro Tour I've ever played in my life, we play against Neil Reeves, Sam Gummersall, and Mark Herbeholz, which were like three of, you know, top players at the time.
Yeah.
So, and we, you know, we got smashed, of course.
That must have been, again, I'm imagining what they're thinking. You know, they're just looking at this like, oh, what's going on here? Like, are we being trolled? Like,
yeah.
So then after that, you spend a good 3 or 4 years grinding the PTQ circuit and going to different pro tours, and you did this all while going to school.
Yep.
How did you keep it all going? Like, it sounds intimidating to think about.
Are you talking about for college or high school?
Sure, let's do
but,
both.
Yeah, both. after I started playing FNM in 2001, I haven't actually stopped playing for that entire time. So I've been playing for about 13 years running in tournaments. But yeah, when I started grinding in PTQs, after that pro tour, I was like, you know, that was really awesome. I want to keep going. Back then they had the pro lounge, so you would have free food, video games. You know, they had like ping pong tables, pool tables. It was like a super cool thing to do. And
was that at Cheapies or pro tours?
Pro tours. They had the, it was called the Pro Players Club. They've done away with it. It's, they haven't had that in like, oh, God, it's been, like, maybe 6 years, I think, since they've had that. So they would, you know. So even if I qualified for a pro tour and expected to do badly, I would, you know, it was just a really cool experience because, you know, you get to see everyone, all the pros, which was a big thing to me at that point because, I didn't play too many Grand Prix at that time. So I was, you know, like, oh, my God, it's, like, such and such, you know. Like, I read your articles. I'm seeing you in person. This is great.
Yeah.
So I wanted to go back for more. So I started grinding the PTQ circuit. I started just by playing in Michigan, but I, you know, eventually worked my radius around for PTQs that I would be willing to travel to like, you know, 5 hours. So after a while, I would go, you know, almost every weekend to a PTQ if there was one. You know, if it was either like Detroit, Columbus, Pittsburgh, or Indianapolis, or even Kentucky, sometimes I'd go down there. So there was a lot of traveling to be done. Yeah, I had a cool group of people that, you know, some of them, you know, keep playing. You know, I play with, like, Brian DeMars. We'd go with him, and sometimes I go with, like, Adam Yurchik. And, you know, there was, like, a cool group of very solid players at that time that were grinding the PTQ circuit.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really
cool. But how did you keep it all going? It's like, you know, you're going to school and you're traveling and you're trying to be on your game. That's got to be tough.
Yeah, I wish I spent more time on school, you know, when I look back on it. Obviously, yeah. My grades were not amazing because I was, you know, out of the state pretty much every weekend that there would be a PTQ. So, I mean, would I do that again? I'm not sure. You know, but I got to meet a lot of cool people along the way, so I think I would do that again.
Mm-hmm. Did your parents know what you were doing at the time? Like, did they know that you were chasing this dream, or what did they think you were doing with your free time?
Oh, they knew exactly what I was doing. My parents, my relatives, they all knew what was going on, and they were pretty supportive of it. I don't think all parents are. But
yeah.
I definitely got yelled at a lot, you know, if I would stay out too late. You know, I'd, like, test at a friend's house, you know, till, like, 6 a.m. and sleep in till, you know, 2 a.m. It was – I feel like I could have did it better if I could have a chat with my 16-year-old self.
Mm-hmm. So what advice would you have for people that might want to get on the Pro Tour train? Because there's been a lot of talk about whether or not PTQs, especially with how big PTQs have gotten lately, there's been a lot of talk about whether or not that's an effective vehicle to get there anymore, and that with GPs getting as big as they have now, I've heard, like, I know when GP Richmond was happening, there were people that were like, this is like a giant PTQ. Like, you have a better chance of getting on the Pro Tour by going to a big GP than you do a PTQ. Do you agree with that, or would you still recommend that people do the PTQs and the GPs and sort of diversify like that?
I would say when I was trying to qualify for the Pro Tour, I had a very one-track mind. You know, I didn't really care that much about school. I pretty much did it because I know I would regret it if I wouldn't keep going to school later in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the most important thing I would say is, you know, don't stop going to school just because you have something that you want to do that isn't, you know, exactly correlated with doing well in school. Because it's, you know, you'll definitely regret it later in your life. As far as, you know, the giant PTQs and giant Grand Prix, they're super hard to qualify for these days. You know, even if you do well in a Grand Prix, it feels like you don't get nearly the benefits that you did, you know, back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even sometimes if the Grand Prix are, you know, less than, 1,200 people, like, you can top eight and not even qualify for a Pro Tour, which is pretty insane because, you know, back when I would get, you know, top 16 at a Grand Prix back in the day, they would just qualify the entire top 16 no matter how many people were there. So it was, you know, it's definitely a lot harder these days. I would play in both though, just because, you know, if I missed a Pro Tour qualifier back when I wanted to win, no matter what, you know, I was like, I got to get back on the Pro Tour. That was my goal. So I would just feel bad missing any chance I had to not qualify. You know, it's like missing a PTQ. It's like, man, this really sucks. I should really be there, even if I don't win. I want to give it, you know, my best shot to try to get back on the train. So I think if you really want to do that, then, you know, you just got to give it every chance you have because you need so much luck because everyone is so good these days with the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone knows every, you know, all the cards you're playing in your deck. Everyone knows what's going on. Mm-hmm. So it's super competitive.
Yeah, absolutely. Your first time cashing out at a Pro Tour was when you came in second place at Pro Tour San Diego. What was it like to finally do that well?
God, it was crazy. You would think that, like, once you get to the top eight, you'd be, you know, you sit down and all these cameras are on you and there are reporters, like, they're just, like, looking at my hand, like, writing my hand down, you know? It feels almost like it's shifty, you know? Everyone's, like, documenting your every move. Cameras on you, and you know that people are just talking about you behind, you know, behind the camera. So
the Twitch stream and Twitter.
Back then there was there was just like the live webcast at that point.
Okay.
But, yeah, you know, you got like Brian David Marshall talking about, you know, your every move pretty much. So you know, there's a lot of pressure. But I actually wasn't very nervous at all.
No?
No. The reason I wasn't nervous was because I knew that aside from Luis Scott Vargas, everyone in that Pro Tour top eight had never top eight at a Pro Tour before. And for that reason, I knew that everyone was going to be just as nervous as I was feeling before I started thinking about that. So once I got that into my head, I thought, you know, these guys are all nervous. Like, what am I really afraid of? They're all in my shoes. They're all nervous. So I stopped being nervous once I kind of reasoned with myself on how I should be feeling in order to, you know, get to the top four in the finals.
Mm-hmm. What would you attribute that high finish to? Would it be like the way that you prepared? Would it be the people you prepared with? Like, what would you say deserves the credit there?
I would say at this point, it's definitely the people I prepared with.
Yeah.
At that time I played a lot at RAW Hobbies. And as I mentioned, there was a ton of really good players that played at RAW. That was like one of the stores where everyone in the country knew us, because we had, you know, a lot of, you know, really talented players. Mm-hmm. So some of the people that we would draft with and play with on a regular occasion included, you know, Pat Chapin, Brian DeMars, my friend DJ Kastner. He's, like, probably the best player in the world that has never top eight at a Grand Prix or Pro Tour. he was actually good enough where, you know, Luis Scott Vargas and Paul Cheon, like, wouldn't want to play against him at a Grand Prix, like when you would play the counterbalance decks. So he was just absurdly good, so I learned a lot from him.
I think we all have that friend who's like super, super good, and you wonder why they're not, you know, winning more. Not that they're not winning more, but why they're not getting those finishes more.
Yeah, they just never had a big break. But, you know, he's we lived pretty close to each other, so we always practiced for all of our events together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes because, you know, we got Pat Chapin at RAW, he would bring all of his friends. So, you know, we would practice with, you know, we practiced with LSV for Pro Tour Hollywood in 08.
Wow.
So, you know, I lent him my deck to play FNM. So it was like pretty cool because I never met him before.
Yeah.
So I had like a ton of really great players around me to help me get to that stage.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel any sort of pressure afterwards where it's like, you know, you're thrust into this limelight and, you know, you're this, you know, sort of unknown kid and you get to second, you know, do you feel any pressure to keep it going or what goes through your mind at that point? Like, where do you go from there?
Well, it was kind of weird because, I'd never top eight at a Pro Tour or a Grand Prix at that point. My closest finish was that I got ninth place at Grand Prix Minneapolis like a few months before that, which is how I qualified for that Pro Tour to begin with. So I was, you know, I don't think it was really pressure, but when you get second at a Pro Tour, you get 20 pro points, and that puts you on the gravy train. So because Pro Tour San Diego was in February, it gave me gravy train status at that point, and that was the first Pro Tour of the year, so it qualified me for every Pro Tour in 2010 and every Pro Tour in 2011.
Wow.
But the more pro points you accumulate, you know, they start paying for your plane tickets and you get appearance fees. And, you know, I already had three buys at all the Grand Prix from that because 20 was the magic number for that. So I knew I was given a great opportunity and I didn't want it to go to waste. So it was more for me to, you know, to do as best as I possibly could in that season so I could, you know, get as many benefits as possible for 2010, and because it carried over to 2011.
Mm-hmm.
So
you were thinking big picture, like you had a plan for yourself, it sounds like.
Yeah, you top eight a Pro Tour, it's, you know, that was obviously a dream of mine for a really long time. So once I got there, you know, it, on one hand, I felt like, okay, I made it, you know, I did what I wanted to do. So I pretty much just had to seize the moment and, you know, put myself in good position to get to a higher pro status because, you know, you always want more.
Mm-hmm. I really enjoy hearing about pros that have a plan because I feel like there's too many pros that, or even just grinders, where, you know, when you ask them what's next, they're like, I don't know. Or, you know, you ask them, like, you know, so you did really well at this event. How did you do good? I don't know. know. They just have this sort of, you know, random approach to things where they don't know why they're good. They don't know why they're there. They don't know how they got there. They don't know what they're going to do next. It's very fly by the seat of your pants. I always appreciate people who say, you know, I did well because of blah, or I need to earn this many pro points, or I need to earn, you know, this many open points. You know, I like seeing people with a plan. I don't get these grinders that just show up. And they're like, I'm just going to go here, and whatever happens. And it's just like, how do you do that? Like, I don't really understand. So I really like that you answered some of those questions very well. Like, you can thank your team. You knew what you wanted to do next. You knew what you were aiming for. I'd really like to see more of that.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I just have a type A personality. So I'm you know, I think far enough into the future, and eventually the future happens. But that's, you know, that's just kind of my thing. But, yeah, there's definitely a ton of people who have, you know, they think the opposite way.
Yeah. So then after that pro tour that you did really well in, you started writing for Star City Games.
Mm-hmm.
How did that get started?
So, like, maybe 10 minutes after I got my trophy, Evan Irwin approached me. And he's like, hey, Kyle, welcome to the Magic Show. This is, you know, he does his thing. And he's
we
like, got
to country it up a little bit. Like, howdy, yeah. Kyle, welcome to the Magic Show.
You know? So, yeah, he's like, congratulations on your pro tour finish. How would you like to be on Star City Games? So he, you know, they kind of gave me a test run, and I wrote my tournament report. And I guess, you know, people liked it because it's pretty hard to not have something to say when you're just winning for, you know, days in a row. So
yeah.
It was, you know. When you write a tournament report where you're doing well, it's really easy compared to when you're not.
Well, it is tricky to make a tournament report interesting because we see so many of them, and I always admire those pros or those grinders who can make it sound interesting or who can put themselves into it, because it's very easy to, you know, get lost in technicality where it's, you know, my name is Kyle Bogames, and today I will break down the finer points of the matches that I obliterated at this team, and you're like, and you're bored, you know, but if you can put yourself in there, you know, we want to follow along with you, and that's always enjoyable.
Agreed. I think there's, like, maybe 5 people that are writing on popular websites right now that can actually execute, you know, the stereotypical tournament report.
Mm-hmm.
But most of them, it's like, even when I, you know, when I was winning, I was thinking, like, okay, how do I have to structure this? I'm looking at the Word doc, and it's like, you know, round 3, round 4, round 5, and it's just like, so formulaic that I'm getting bored writing it. So how's a stranger going to feel when they're reading it?
Mm-hmm. And then you went on to not only write for Star City, but Channel Fireball, TCG Player, and Gathering Magic?
And Black Border.
That's impressive. Like, you must really like writing about Magic.
Well, yeah. It's really cool to have, like, a soapbox. You know, I think everyone wants to be heard at some point. So it's, you know, it was great. It's like, hey, I have a cool deck. You know, I want to share it with the world. So, you know, I have great opportunities to be able to do that. And, that, you know, not everyone does. So, you know, I'm, like, really grateful that I'm able to do that.
Mm-hmm. So take me behind the scenes a little bit, Kyle. What was it like writing for each of those sites? Like, how was writing for TCG Player versus writing for Channel Fireball versus writing for Gathering Magic? Like, did you enjoy one more than the others, or did one, you know, function more smoothly? Break that down for me.
Okay, so basically it's the way I wrote for each site and the articles I could write was pretty much a function of the editor. You know, some websites, they were more strict and they had a clearer picture for what they wanted to do with the articles. Others were more loose and I, you know, had more of a soapbox and could just rant about anything. Mm-hmm. So, Channel Fireball is definitely the one where they gave me the most freedom in writing what I wanted to talk about, which, mm-hmm. you know, was sometimes good and sometimes bad because I was, like, 21 years old and pretty much just talking about whatever random shit came into my head. So, I was, you know, I definitely shot myself in the foot in several times.
Yeah. Oh, we'll talk about that.
Okay. All right, what do you want to know about me shooting myself on the foot?
Well, I was actually going through your articles, like I did, because like I said earlier, I went through all of your articles.
Yep.
I have seven, whenever I stalk somebody, I open all my tabs in Chrome, I'll have seven articles, your Facebook, your LinkedIn, I'm pretty thorough. And there was one article you wrote that I found very interesting, given current events, and you wrote an article, and you had basically talked about the idea that certain cards or certain formats are too expensive, and that when people complain about not getting into a format or not playing a certain deck because they can't afford it, you had basically said at the time that if they wanted it bad enough, they would just get the cards anyway. And that's very interesting to me because there's been a lot of talk lately about how expensive Modern is and how Modern is now worse than Legacy in a lot of ways. And there's been talk about that they're not reprinting cards fast enough and that this is really turning into a problem. I read one article the other day that talked about Modern having a bubble and the potential of that bubble popping. And then we had that issue with counterfeit cards where people were saying, you know, we're having to do this because the cards are so expensive. We're being driven to use these fakes and things like that. Do you still feel that way? Like, do you still feel like these cards being expensive is not a problem and that people should just deal with it? Or are you sort of, have you changed your opinion on that a little bit?
So I guess whether or not the cards are expensive or not, you know, you're always going to have to be faced with the decision of getting these cards versus getting pretty much anything else in your life. So I do agree on, you know, with 21-year-old me that, you know, if you do want it bad enough, you'll be able to do whatever it is you want. And, you know, I'm grateful that Magic was able to teach me that at such a relatively young age because, you know, I feel some people don't know that and they can go their whole life without knowing that. So, it's, I feel like I lost my train of thought here. So, yeah, the cards are expensive. Looking back on it, Jace being $100, like, pretty small potatoes compared to what happens today, I think it's actually a problem today. And the reason it is because there were much less people playing Magic back in those days, so it was more like, you know, the supply and demand wasn't as skewed as it was today. Now we can look at, you know, WotC made decisions to produce, you know, X amount of cards to satisfy the players of, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. And now they're making Modern really popular. And they have that same amount of supply, but they're not doing too much about adding additional cards to it. So when, you know, when they try to keep, after Hasbro acquired it, you know, the game shot through the roof. So we're left dealing with this new issue of the growth of the game. So there's, you know, there's a lot of people playing Modern, but I don't think that there's enough people playing Modern given how popular Magic is, and that's because the cards are so expensive. And we're living in a time where it's like the old cards, people are so sure that they're going to do nothing but go up in price, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy because they stop trading them, you know, making the supply issue even worse. You know, they fall into someone's hands who wants them, and they just sit on them because they know that they're going to be worth more tomorrow than they are today. You know, it's a classic deflation issue. So, you know, I think it's a huge problem. But back then, I you know, the cards, they really weren't that expensive. But today, I think it's a big problem. And it's, you know, there's a fundamental issue behind it rather than just not wanting it bad enough.
Yeah, because, I mean, even, like, I started playing Modern. I was tired of the current standard, like I think some of us are. And I started playing Modern around, like, Thanksgiving, Christmas time of last year, 2013. Yeah. And at the time, I started playing Living End because I thought it was the most affordable option for me. And it was very much my play style, so I was very attracted to it. And even then, it was, like, having to make the initial investment of Shocklands. It was, like, at the time, I had to pay for 4 Fulminator Mages. And mind you, I have store credit, so, from doing my shows. So when I say pay, I didn't really have to, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, still a big opportunity cost.
Oh, yeah. Those were shows. It was like 8 shows to pay for so many cards, yep. You know. But so I had to pay – I paid about $160 for my playset of Fulminators because you needed 4 Fulminators. Mm-hmm. And then you needed 4 Verdant Catacombs, which is about another $160. And then this was when Travis Wu was advocating Grove of the Burwillows over Copperline Gorge. So I had my Copperline Gorge, but Travis Wu was like, you know, you need Burwillows. And I was like, anything you say, Travis Wu. So $160 for the Burwillows. And that even felt like it stung a little bit when I made that initial investment. And I was at work the other day, and I was going through the Living End primer on Salvation, because I'm a masochist, and it was so funny starting at page 1 and seeing people in, like, early 2013 going, Fulminator's $15! I'm not paying that! And you look at it now, and it's, like, 42.
Yeah.
And it's so crazy how in a year that has changed. And that's a card that not even that many people are playing with. I was looking up Verdant Catacombs. I was at SCG Milwaukee. Like I said, that's, like, $80 now. Mm-hmm. And I paid $45 a pop in November, which felt like a lot. And it's just like, how did this happen? Like, you're looking at your watch and you're like, not much time has passed. Like, this is crazy. And I'm a big fan of a site called MTG Goldfish.
Okay.
And they give you a breakdown of the online metagame and the paper metagame as well, and then they give you an average price for that deck. And even if I wanted to build something other than Living End, Malira Pod average cost $1,300. I've got a pretty good living. Like, I'm not hurting or anything, but I don't know if I – and that's the thing. I don't know if you can say I want it. Maybe I don't want it bad enough, but when I see 1,300, that's a little crazy. Like, I can go on the standard side, and Esper Control's about 475. I'd pay 475 for a deck. I would do that. But Twin, average cost $1,600. I don't know anybody who wants it that bad. Like, that's you got to want it pretty bad to pay that.
Right. And but, you know, at the same time, you know, you see a lot of, you know, you see all the people who are grinding and, like, top eighting PTQ after PTQ, like, trying to, you know, get to eventually a win where they can qualify for the pro tour and get on the train. Like, you never see anyone in an interview where they're saying, like, you know, I wanted to play this deck, so I didn't do as well as I hoped, but, you know, the economy and these card prices, it's rough, you know, but it really sucks at this point. And there's definitely an issue, but it's good that WotC's trying to address this issue now. You know, by making aggressively reprinting cards that are modern staples. Like, you know, they did a good job with Thoughtseize and Mutavault and the Shocklands especially. But
which is funny, because since those things got reprinted, I rarely see any of those cards in modern.
Yeah, you need like 2, and then you need all these fetch lands that cost $100 now.
Yeah, I remember I was playing someone the other day. I was playing an Affinity deck, and he played a Thoughtseize, and I was like, really? Like, I haven't seen one of those in a while. I'm like, is this standard? And they're like, no, it used to be a modern thing, and I just haven't seen any modern decks running it lately. And I was like, huh, that's very interesting. Okay, here's my hand. And like, very strange. But I love moderns. It makes me very sad that it's sort of like this now, because I've had the most fun playing in 6 months playing modern, and it makes me really sad when I try to get people on board, and they're like, cool, what do I need to get started? Ooh, no. Yeah. And then they see those prices, and they won't even go near it, so it bums me out a little bit. And I also feel, like I said, sort of trapped, where I love Living End, I have a lot of fun with Living End. Living End doesn't always post the greatest results, but I've already invested in it. Like, for me to invest in something else, I already feel I've invested enough in Living End. I don't know if I want to do that again. So I do feel sort of trapped with the deck I'm in now. So
I mean, Modern's an interesting format, because I kind of view the old cards like financial assets, because at this point, the amount of money you spend into it, you're pretty much making an investment, and you know, most of the money you get back is that, you know, when it comes time to sell it, it's worth a lot more than it was. So, and then in addition, you get extra return when you're winning with the deck. So that's kind of how I view it. Maybe it's a little too cerebral, but like maybe it, like, at the core, it's a game, but there's a lot of money on the table, like, in terms of the cards themselves and how much money you can win. But,
absolutely.
You know, Modern itself, I think, is probably one of my favorite formats, because I just get to play all the fun blue cards.
I enjoy it, just like I said, for the variety of it. It's like, you know, even with Living End not being considered a top tier deck anymore, depending on who you ask, you know, there is that one GP where it'll win, you know, or you'll be online. And I remember when I was practicing with Living End for GP Richmond, I just discovered these decks. Like, I was playing against this really bizarre red deck that I'd never seen before, and it had all these cards I'd never seen before, like Mages of the Moon, Koth of the Hammer, whatever. And I got done with it, and I was like, what is this? I remember tweeting it, and they were like, that's called Scred Red.
Yep.
And I'm like, what is this? And then I look it up, and like, it was a thing in like 2009.
Yep.
And there are just these decks that you never know what you're going to run into. I ran into one deck that was like Tezzeret Control. Like, he shit out a bunch of artifacts and a Staring Bridge and was like, yeah, you're going to lose double life equal to how many artifacts I got. That's game. Thanks. And I'm like, what just happened here? Like, there's just so much randomness, and you never know what you're going to face. Ad Nauseam. I remember the first time I played that for the first time. I love that. I love that you never know what you're going to get into. You never know what's going to happen when they go off. It's really fun to watch.
Yeah, there's like 1,000 decks you could play, and most of them were, you know, pretty much when you want to catch someone off guard, you know, you do what you said. You play like Scred Red or something super obscure that people haven't played in like, you know, 5 years.
Yeah, I remember the first time I played against the Hate Bears deck. It was just like I'm watching him, and he goes, I got a Leonin Arbiter. And I'm like, okay, good for you. And then he goes, Blade Splicer. And I'm like, okay, you know, so you got a little white thing going, good for you. And he's just playing, they don't seem to have anything in common. And I'm like, what is the point of this deck? And he goes, oh, that's Hate Bears. And I'm like, okay, like, that's a thing? Like, all right, you know, whatever. But, you know, it's just so random when it's happening. You're like, what is this? And I love that.
Yeah, that's definitely a format where it helps a lot to be playing for a long time. Because I've played against a lot of these decks in Standard, you know, but they're just super old now. Makes me feel old because people are like, you know, what the hell is this? Like, what, you weren't playing Standard when this, you know, when this was a thing? Like, everyone played this deck.
But I like it because it does feel like everything sort of has a shot, where if it's just that right time and no one's expecting that deck, it can just come at you, and that's cool.
Yeah.
So you were recently put back into the spotlight after you won first place at GP Cincinnati.
Yep.
How did it feel to be on top?
Man, it was really weird. You know, I got into top eight. I practiced for maybe like, you know, 5 or 6 hours for the tournament. I hadn't top-aided a premier level event since 2010, so it's, you know, been a good 3.5-4 years, depending on the time. And I don't know. It was really bizarre because it's really hard to top-8 Grand Prix these days. You have to go 13-2. There's over 1,700 people. It's a crazy amount. Those were like unheard of numbers when I was playing.
Yeah.
I was, you know, like, they had some tournaments that were that big, but they were very few and far between. So when I got into the top eight, I was, again, I don't think I was that nervous. You know, I feel like my top eight opponent played well, but he said I was happy to be there. And I feel like, I don't know, I kind of feel like I win when people say things like that. Because
that they're happy to be playing you?
That they're just happy to be there. Like,
was that Brad Nelson?
No, I forget the name.
Okay.
But I think he's from New York. He played well and everything, but it's not even him in particular. But, you know, just like that thought, you know, happy to be there. I was happy to be there from the sense that I haven't, you know, top eight in a really long time, and I didn't put really too much effort into the event. So, you know, I was extremely lucky to make it that far. But, I was still in the tournament and I had a job to do. So I kept playing like, you know, my hardest, even though, you know, everyone's watching me. And I'm, you know, kind of nervous that I'm going to screw up because, you know, everyone's talking, you know, like on Twitch about me, I'm sure. So I was like, okay, I'm going to try my best not to embarrass myself. I am still very rusty. Mm-hmm. I was playing like shit all weekend.
Well, that's good to know. For those of us who are like, tell us some tips, and you're like, play like shit.
Yeah, it was interesting. That was the first tournament I've ever played in where I like, I didn't start double checking my deck list that I turned in until, like, the judge was coming over, you know. I played Esper Control not because I thought it was the best position deck, but because when I was getting my ass kicked, that was going to be the most fun deck. Because, mm-hmm. you know, I enjoy playing the blue deck, so I, you know, I get some time off work, so I go to Grand Prix Cincinnati, and, you know, just to have pretty much a fun weekend. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I just wasn't expecting it happened. So, you know, I'm sure there's something to that.
Mm-hmm. Were there any matches or opponents that you faced that really stood out to you at your time there?
So playing for top eight, I played against Deshaun Baylock, and he, mm-hmm. you know, he's also from Michigan. And I played against him at his first PTQ, and, like, he's really good. And he got, like, since we played, you know, he's gotten quite good. And I mm-hmm. I almost felt bad winning because he just played much better than I did, you know. So it's like, yeah. But he actually won a PTQ recently, mm-hmm. like, just after. So, you know, he played really well. And he was also the first person I played against who was playing Obsidat. And that was probably the worst card for my deck. I had to cast four Sphinx's Revelations just to not die from the draining effect, because he never attacked with it. He just, like, you know, sat there, sat back, passed the turn, drained me every turn. And that was, you know, really hard to play against. So that was, mm-hmm. you know, I won with Aetherling at one life. Oh. Just from, you know, just from this draining effect. It's really hard to race from my deck. So that was by far the toughest match that I played.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like your victory in Cincinnati, like, reinvigorated you in any way? Like, you've got that competitive fire back? Like, where do you go from here?
So, basically, whenever I see someone who, you know, kind of falls off the radar and then, you know, has a big comeback, they get automatically back into Magic. But I'm not going to do that because, you know, I'm going to school and I'm working. I have a couple different jobs. And so I have a lot of work to do and not very much free time. So I pretty much went into the top eight deciding, like, you know, okay, I'm going to qualify for this pro tour and I'm going to go to the pro tour and I'm going to try to do well in it. But, you know, I'm not going to try to go to every Grand Prix and chase all the pro points. Because, again, I mean, I actually played like shit. So I, you know, I just don't want to spend all my time practicing for all the Grand Prix when, you know, this might be my one shot, you know. So I was mm-hmm. I was happy to make it to the finals and actually win, because I really suck at winning in the finals of pretty much any tournament.
mm-hmm. But this does let you go to the next Pro Tour, right?
Yeah, I qualified for Portland, and okay. So I'm going to go to that at the beginning of August, and it's standard, so that's cool. So I can maybe play a similar deck, and then I get to draft core set. So those are pretty much the same thing.
You said the Pro Tour is in the beginning of August?
Yep.
In Portland?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, because isn't GP Portland in August, too?
Yeah, I think it's the weekend after the Pro Tour.
Okay, because I was going to say, yeah, Pro Tour Oregon, I'm looking at August 1st through the 3rd. Yeah, the GP is the 14th and the 15th, I believe.
Okay.
I was going to say, that'd be freaky if they were at the same time. Like, wow.
They did have that once at Pro Tour Paris. I went to that and didn't make day two, so I played this, like, 2,200-person Grand Prix, like, for the next day. I was just, like, just didn't have the will to slug through that.
Yeah.
But I don't think they've done it since then. No, that was, like, in 2011.
I was going to say, it'd be incredibly awkward, especially for what we have planned. I don't know if you know this, Kyle, but we're planning a ladies' weekend at Portland. I don't know if you know Heather from Gathering Magic or Vised Angel. We have dubbed GP Portland the GP Vagina, and we have as many lady magic players as we can. We want to get them to converge on one spot for one weekend, and we're going to get together in teams of three and just beat all the boys and have a fabulous weekend. So,
okay.
Just saying.
Yeah, I haven't heard about it. Is it the Pro Tour or the Grand Prix?
The Grand Prix.
Okay. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah,
so we're bringing out the big guns. We've got MJ, Tifa, Natasha, me, Heather. We're leaving no stone unturned. If it's a lady that plays Magic, we're dragging her there, and we're going to rock it out. So if you're there, God help you, because there are going to be stampedes of women coming for your hide. I'm just saying. You're not prepared. So the last thing I wanted to touch on is, when I was looking into your background, I noticed that you have a bachelor's degree in economics,
mm-hmm.
and you're working on a master's in finance, and you're also a financial planner?
I work at Barracuda Networks as a financial planning and analysis intern.
Okay, so it seems like you have a lot of background in finance. So do you ever dabble in the magic side of finance, like the trading and the costs and speculation? Does it appeal to you at all?
So I've written some articles. There's one on TCG Player where it delved, you know, pretty deep into financial theory, and I think it was received pretty well. I think people like it when you write about something that's not magic, but you apply it to magic. Like there's a lot of psychology articles. People always love those. So I tried one with finance, and you know, I did enjoy writing about that. But as far as like, you know, devoting an entire column to it, I don't know, you know, because there's a lot of them that do that. So I try to these days I try to write only when I have something unique to say. I was going to actually write about the real estate bubble in lands recently, but then I read an article that was exactly what I was going to say, so I stopped there. Like, well said. You know, couldn't have said it better myself. All right, I'm not going to write this anymore. Like,
I hate when that happens.
It kind of sucked. On the other hand, it's, like, cool that people are thinking, you know, like, you're not completely off. But, yeah, I wanted to write it. But, yeah, I didn't want to just, you know, vomit this entire article.
Was this before or after you won the GP in Cincinnati?
This was before.
Okay. So I was going to say, if it would have been after, you could have totally pulled, like, a, don't you know who I am? And and then they'd have to delete it. Like, we're really sorry, sir. And then, you know, throw your weight around a little bit.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, I think I could write a lot more than, you know, than I am right now. But, I, you know, it's just, like, really hard to write an article every week about something when, you know, when you don't play as often as you used to.
Yeah. I'm amazed at how people like Conley do it. He writes for two different sites and comes up with weekly articles. Like, I tip my hat to him.
Conley's been doing that for like 4 years, and yeah, I don't know how he does it.
Man, it's even hard coming up with a weekly show sometimes, you know, figuring out who my guest is going to be and coming up with interesting topics. And I've only been doing this about 2 years.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, you need to be creative once a week. You have to be.
Yeah, and it's hard.
People are going to hate your stuff.
Yeah, and it's really hard. And I, you're going to take it and you're going to like it.
You better hope it's good. Republish it.
Well, I have to say, Kyle, you know, I certainly hope that you do write more because I do like your stuff, and I'm very proud to be sharing the stage with you on Gathering Magic. And anytime you do write something, I'll certainly plug you, and it's always a pleasure to see your stuff.
No, thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Kyle, if anybody's enjoyed listening to you on the show, where can they find you? How can they get a hold of you?
I'm on Facebook. I have a Gmail account, kmbogamus@gmail.com. And let's see. I guess I'm not like too up with all the social media stuff. So I
know. I tried to stalk you.
Yeah, it's I'm hard to stalk, I think.
Okay, and it's Bogamus, not Bogamus?
Bogamus, yep.
Bogamus. Okay, because I wasn't sure going into it. I was like Boheme, like Bohemus. I was trying to be all pretentious about it, but I'm glad I didn't do that. So it's Kyle Bogamus.
There are some people at the Grand Prix who were, you know, calling me a feature match, and they just weren't saying it right.
How did they say it?
You know, it's usually Bogamus.
Okay.
It was helpful in the 90s, like, when a telemarketer's calling you. Like, you know if it's, like, a random person because they screw your name up.
Okay. There's so many ways to do it, though, like Bogeems.
Yeah.
Bogeems.
It doesn't really make any sense, I don't think, how it's pronounced. It's what I was told, it's how to say it, and I've just been saying it the same way.
I mean, there's so many ways we could take it. We could make you French, we could make you German, we could make you, I mean, you could be anything we want you to be.
I have many nicknames, too.
What are they?
Well, I have Borborgimos, Boggles. there's a lot of things you can do with Bogamus. You know, like it rhymes with hippopotamus, so, you know, the opportunities are endless.
It's a good thing you're not overweight, because that would be a really easy chap to get at you, you know?
Yeah, that's a good reason to stay in shape, I think.
Hippobogamous, here he's coming, you know?
It's too easy, and...
I know, I used to get that all the time when I was a kid, because I was a redhead, and my last name, my real last name ends in Berg, and I used to get all the, you know, Burger, Ronald McDonald, ha-ha, redhead. It's like, really? Like, oh, come on, you know? or the Red Baron. I'm like, how is that bad? Like, I look cool and I'm on a pizza. That's not an insult, you know? So kids sometimes aren't the most, you know, smart when it comes to insulting you. But yeah. Hippopotamus is pretty smooth, though. I gotta give it to them.
Yeah,
so.
That would definitely be too easy, and it would start with the life. I'm glad that's the first time I'm hearing that one.
You're going to hear it in your dreams.
Yeah.
Well, Kyle, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really did have fun getting to know you, and I'm sure my listeners did as well. And like I said, I'll be looking forward to seeing you on Gathering Magic and maybe seeing you at the Pro Tour and then maybe even meeting you sometime. It would be really awesome.
Well, yeah, stop by at the Pro Tour. I'll definitely be there.
Absolutely. And if anyone's listening and you've enjoyed what you've heard here on the Deck Tees, you can always find the show first and foremost on GatheringMagic.com. The show is also on iTunes and Stitcher. Please subscribe and leave me a review and some stars. You can also follow the show on Twitter at the Deck Tees. I am also on Twitter at OriginalEstress. You can also email me personally at estress@elitistjerks.com. Thank you all so much for listening, and please take care of yourselves, okay? Bye.